This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my special co-host for today, Dennis Hart, who you may recognize as KHOI's civic reporter. Hi, Dennis.
Susan, hello. Good morning. Really good to be here in Ames for my summer vacation instead of on tape, as I've been for the last 33 weeks or so I can finally be here with you live and in person. It's nice.
We just started playing your weekly update from the regional weeklies on Local Talk Wednesday, which features our surrounding area. I was reluctant to do that because I know the regional weeklies don't appear until Wednesday or Thursday. How do you avoid giving us week-old news? I know you have a special relationship with Gateway Media, the publisher of all those papers, but that doesn't allow you special previews, does it?
No, they're not going to give me their scoops that they're going to have on their print editions when they come out on Wednesday and Thursday. But they often put up stories on their websites ahead of publication, especially council stories, sometimes supervisor stories, etc. So what I do is I will go online a few days before I'm scheduled to be on the air here on Wednesday mornings, and I'll look to see what they have. And they don't, as I say, put everything up. But especially things like governmental meetings, occasionally what we call spot news stories, if there is a weather event or something that has impacted the communities, they'll put that up on their websites. So I can get that and put something together so that it looks often as if, when I'm putting this on the air on Wednesday, as if I am scooping them, because it's going to appear on the front page of the story or their paper on Thursday.
Well, of course, we're really big supporters of these weeklies. We rely on them. We think they're of enormous value as anchors to their communities. Do you think this helps them?
Yeah, I think so, and I'll tell you why. It's not a matter that I'm taking their thunder away. Some people might think that. But remember that what I'm doing is a summary of their stories. The full story you have to get in the newspaper. They will often do long takeouts, feature stories about prominent people in the community. I'm certainly not going to do that entire story. I might do two or three lines, and I often say, as you will know, I'll say, you can read the full story in the newspaper. So consider what I do, perhaps a preview, yes, but a headline service, directing people to actually read the paper to get the full amount of information. Print provides much more information than broadcasting ever can, radio or television, on virtually any story, because they have more space than we have time.
That's right. But we have the voices. Well, let's hear your take out your selections from this week's papers.
Okay. Let's start with the Nevada Journal, which is going to report, you'll see it tomorrow in the paper, on the visit to Nevada last week of the Chief United States Agricultural Trade Negotiator. Greg Dowd stopped in Nevada last Thursday before he went to the World Pork Expo in Des Moines. He said President Trump fully intends to put his proposed $50 billion tariffs on Chinese goods into effect soon. He said those tariffs are designed to punish China's alleged intellectual property theft from U.S. tech companies trying to enter their markets. China has responded by proposing tariffs, as you know, on a range of American products, including beef, corn, and soybeans, all of which are of interest here in Iowa. The Journal also reports that two sister companies are planning to build a new 34,000-square-foot manufacturing plant in Nevada later this year. That's good news for Nevada. Mid-States Material Handling and Fabrication and Mid-States Millwright and Builders produce and install grain bins, work platforms, and other metal structures used by ethanol producers, farmers, and food-producing plants. Construction of that new facility is going to take place starting this summer next to the company's current 16,000-square-foot location on South B in Nevada. The Journal also reports, again tomorrow, that the Burke Corporation in Nevada has donated 1,000 pounds of meat products to the Nevada School's Food for Thought program, which helps feed children during the summer. And you'll also read a story about how the Nevada School's nutrition program is going to continue over this summer, partly with the help of that donation, providing up to 700 meals a week in that community. That's good news. Also in the Journal, unfortunately, some bad news, and occasionally we have to report that. A Nevada woman died in a rural Boone County crash over the weekend. The victim identified as 26-year-old Alyssa Carol August. The Iowa State Patrol said she was a passenger in a vehicle that was struck by another vehicle. There's also word in this week's Journal that Dave Burling who is the associate pastor in Nevada's Memorial Lutheran Church, soon going to be leaving for a new post in Story City, where he's going to become pastor to Bethany Life Ministries. And I'm sure you'll hear more about that here on Local Talk. Also in the Journal, word that the Colo City Council approved spending about $21,000 to reroute a sewer line running under the fire station's driveway. The new line going to run onto Bailey Street and help fix the issue of sewer lines freezing during colder weather. The city's also going to rebuild culverts between 4th and 6th Streets along Bailey Street to improve stormwater drainage. And one more note from the Journal. If you still can't get over the loss of Elvis and Johnny Cash, well, fear not. Elvis impersonator Joseph Hall and Cash impersonator Paul Eve both going to appear on stage together this coming Saturday, June 16th, at Nevada's Talent Factory. I don't know who I want to see more, Elvis or Johnny Cash again. In the Boone News Republican, the big news is Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst's annual Roast and Ride fundraiser, which started in Des Moines this past Saturday and wound up at the Central Iowa Expo Center outside Boone. Hundreds of people showed up to see and hear Ernst, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, and the keynote speaker, Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. Ernst told the crowd about what she considers President Trump's recent successes, including judges he's appointed across the country and the nation's low jobless rate. Governor Reynolds, who will face Democrat Fred Hubbell in the general election this fall, said that election is critical because, in her words, it's going to help decide who we are as a people and what kind of Iowa we're going to pass on to our children. Congressman Gowdy, who will retire from office this year, said the Republican Party needs to tell people how it's, in his words, the party of hope. He said one Republican talking point should be peace through strength. In the Story City Herald, word that the Story County Community Foundation will award a so-called major grant of up to $25,000 in November. Anyone interested in applying must submit an intent to apply form by July 31st. Past grants have been awarded to such entities as the Cambridge Volunteer Fire Department, Story County Conservation, and Heartland Senior Services. One more newspaper. In the Tri-County Times, word that the State Auditor's Office released a report late last week that alleged the Huxley Fire and Rescue Association had more than $5,500 in improper and unsupported disbursements of its funds from 2012 through last year. The investigation had been requested by Fire Chief Chad Anthony. He said the former president and secretary of the association have been removed from their positions and replaced by new members. So there, Susan, is your summary of what happened last week and what people will see later today in the Story City Herald and tomorrow in the other outlying newspapers.
And our next guest is going to bring us some stories that haven't hit the papers yet. We have Leanne Harder here for her monthly report from Story County.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm going to start out with some exciting news that happened this past Saturday. As you may know, there's a new road between Ames, a paved road, now going north out of Ames up to Gilbert, just south of the high school. That's commonly called Gretton or Grant Avenue.
Excuse me, isn't that a bike path rather than a road?
Well, it's a combination of both.
Is
and that's
it?
What we celebrated on Saturday. It was a ribbon cutting to actually celebrate the new bike trail that accompanies the paving of the road. It's, again, between Ames and Gilbert. It's a 10-foot-wide paved bike trail. It's off-road, so it does allow for safety of both pedestrians and bicycles. And it really came about from after the new Gilbert High School was completed. Representatives from both the city and school approached the Story County Board of Supervisors and asked that the board consider paving that road. It was a gravel road, highly traveled with school children going to the high school and, you know, other people going to Ames and Gilbert back and forth. The board did approve that, along with approving the improving the roadway to increase safety. There was an opportunity to enter a private-public partnership and create a bike trail to, again, improve safety for pedestrians and bicycles alike. So that ribbon cutting was held this past Saturday. Rick Sanders, chair of the Board of Supervisors, did address those attending, expressing appreciation for the successful partnership that did lead to the paving of the bike trail. Actually, without that partnership, I don't think the bike trail would have occurred. Then Gene Upstill and Roger Underwood both addressed those attending too, and I think we'll just see for great success and growth. Eventually, that will connect all the way down to Ada Hayden once Ames finishes along Grant Avenue. Then switching gears a little bit, mobile crisis response services are now available in Story County. Story County and Central Iowa Community Services and partner organization Ireley Ball Community Mental Health Services have now officially launched the Mobile Crisis Response Services in Story County. These assist individuals experiencing a mental health crisis by providing support during the time of crisis and providing follow-up care to connect the individual to resources and support as needed. Staff respond in teams of two and remain with the callers throughout the entire crisis. It's available to both children and adults alike that are experiencing difficulties with depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, other mental illnesses. You can access the mobile response services by calling the crisis line 24 hours per day, 7 days a week, and that number is 1-844-258-8858. When someone does call that crisis line, a trained counselor is there to assist the caller and really assess the needs of the caller in person and help provide preventative care and dispatch a response team, really to address our mental health crisis we're experiencing, and just not in Story County, but nationwide. It's a wonderful service that we're now proud to be able to offer and partner with.
Have you been providing this service? When did this start?
It just launched within the past month.
Have you had any calls so far?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I can get back to you on that.
Okay.
That's a great question. I'd like to say no, but I'd like to say yes, too.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I hope it's being used.
The world we live in, yeah.
There are meetings scheduled for the Healthy Lifestyle Center that's under consideration. If you do want to learn more about the Healthy Lifestyle Center, information is available at the City of Ames website at www.cityofames.org/healthylifecenter. Those meetings have been set in Story City and Huxley. Story City's is June 13th. That's today, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
From 7 to 8 p.m. At the Bertha Bartlett Public Library on Broad Street in Story City. And there's one scheduled next Monday, June 18th, from 7 to 8 p.m. at the Nordkalsum Community Building in Huxley. They're still trying to schedule a meeting for Nevada. The idea is they're getting out into the outlying communities outside the City of Ames to really discuss what the Healthy Lifestyle Center is all about and the impacts to other communities. We have a thing called RAGBRAI coming through Story County.
That is a thing, isn't it?
It is a thing. It's a wonderful thing. But it will have some impacts. And so in that regard, the Board of Supervisors on May 29th of this year did vote to restrict vendors from setting up within the road rights-of-way. So not necessarily on private property, but within that road right-of-way, along the route in the unincorporated areas of the county. Vending, again, is not restricted on private properties along the route, provided they get a special events permit, and that is through the Board of Supervisors. The purpose of that special events permit is to address events lasting longer than 4 hours, so RAGBRAI, we know, will meet that, and involving greater than 250 participants. Well, we know they will meet that. Primary purpose is to focus on protections to participants, volunteers, and spectators involved in the event, including adjacent property owners and motorists. And also helps communicate plans of the event, whether it be a vendor and having a large pancake feed for emergency response entities so that they're better aware of what's happening. You can get those special event permit applications by contacting the Planning and Development Department. You can go on the county's website at www.storycountyiowa.gov. Go under Planning and Development, under the Government tab, and go to Applications and Permits. You can also call the Planning and Development Department at 515-382-7245. And then June is actually Watershed Awareness Month. The Board of Supervisors last week did pass a proclamation noting such. It really is to celebrate what we've been doing and what we continue to do and what the future holds. On June 6th, Prairie Rivers of Iowa and Story County Conservation unveil new signs that you'll see throughout the county along watershed boundaries. It's part of an overall educational campaign on the importance of protecting our waters and local watersheds. But next Monday is a very important meeting, too, in watershed planning for Story County. As you know, I've talked about a couple times, in early 2017, the board did contract with an entity to provide countywide watershed assessments throughout Story County. We are the first county to do this in the state of Iowa. To my knowledge, I don't know that any other county is doing it to this degree, too. The preliminary report will be released next Monday night. It's a joint meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission, Story County Conservation Board, and the Board of Supervisors. And then it'll follow up accordingly with the implementation strategies and whatever else it recommends. So I'm really looking forward to the culmination of the work that's been done by the consultant and Story County staff and other entities to get us to this point and what the future holds in regards to protecting our watersheds.
Sounds exciting.
It is. Lastly, 4th of July is actually fast approaching.
Yes.
Just a reminder that most county offices will be closed on the 4th of July. It's the middle of the week. So if you all of a sudden realize you need to renew your tags on July 3rd, you want to come in the you don't want to come in the following day, you need to wait a day. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. I am at 515-382-7247 or via email at lharter@storycountyiowa.gov.
Very quick question. How much planning is the county putting in on RAGBRAI, Register's Annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa? Or is it mostly a city's planning thing? We know they're staying overnight in Ames. How much does the county have to do with this?
Actually, we have quite a few touches on it in several ways. Financially, the Board of Supervisors did approve donating, giving an amount up to $2,500 to those communities impacted by RAGBRAI, so Ames, Nevada, and Colo. We also have Rick Sanders, who's the chair of the board, sitting on the RAGBRAI committee for the City of Ames, the Oversight Steering Committee. I'm involved with the Publicity Committee for RAGBRAI through the City of Ames. The county engineer, obviously, as it's traveling through unincorporated parts of Story County, is highly involved in it with the route. The county sheriff is ensuring that every type of transportation element is positively impacted and any negative elements are addressed in a very safe manner. Our planning and development department, as I said, is charged with looking at special use permits. I think it's touching a lot of parts of Story County. Now, what's interesting, there's limited amount of roadway actually in unincorporated Story County. Now that Ames and Nevada's city boundaries touch, that stretch between Ames and Nevada is all within the city. So that's going to fall under the purview of those two communities.
Okay. I can guarantee you I will not be riding in RAGBRAI, but I'll cheer them on. Thanks, Leanne, very much.
Thank you.
For your report. In case you just tuned in, where have you been? This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Good morning. We've been focusing on Story County news today, starting with my previews from the regional newspapers and continuing with the monthly report from Leanne Harder, to my left, Story County Outreach Coordinator. We're going to supplement that report now with the announcement of an event taking place in Ames that has countywide significance. And to tell us about that, we have Jim Hennessy, Administrator of Child Advocacy Board, speaking on the phone now with us about the 25th anniversary of CASA Court-Appointed Special Advocates. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Thanks for getting up this early. Tell us a little bit about the organization. What is CASA? What's its history?
Well, the CASA program in Story County has been around for 25 years, and we're very proud of that long history. We have great relationships with the juvenile court and with the Department of Human Services there in supporting children who have been abused and neglected and are under the court's jurisdiction. So our program actually recruits volunteers who have a strong passion for helping children that have been abused and neglected to move to a better life. The volunteers receive extensive training for us before they begin their work and ongoing training as they do it to understand child development needs, child welfare services that are available, and how to advocate for the needs of the children that they're assigned to. They are appointed by the court, usually to serve on a single case, often with multiple children. They serve as an extra set of eyes and ears to take responsibility for observing what's going on throughout the entire range of things happening in that child's life. They talk with the child, they talk with the parents, they talk with foster parents if foster parents are involved. They talk with all of the professionals, the educators, everyone who's involved with that child, and their job really is to create a really comprehensive picture of everything that's going on in that child's life to support the court and the Department of Human Services and often the child's attorney or guardian ad litem in providing that comprehensive view of everything that's happening for that child. They pay special attention to what the child needs in terms of safety, in terms of overall well-being, development, education, mental health, physical health needs, and then also pay attention closely to the needs for that child has for permanency in the way of a caring adult in that child's life. They share their information with the court, along with any recommendations that they have about services that might be provided or evidence that might need to be explored around meeting the needs of that child. Make a report to the court periodically for every court hearing that occurs for that child while under the jurisdiction of the court. And again, they share that information with the Department of Human Services worker and the guardian ad litem or the child's attorney almost always. They often serve as kind of the continuous, stable presence in that child's life when in many cases, the child and the family feel like they're going through a pretty tumultuous period. So often a relationship develops between the advocate and the child and the parents during the time that case is under the court supervision that really helps to model and perhaps even mentor them in what they need to do. So that's kind of in a nutshell what our program does. We, you know, currently have about 6,000 children throughout the state of Iowa that are eligible for this service. We only have enough volunteers right now serving in this advocacy role to help about 15% of the children total. Now, in Story County, there's 123 kids that are eligible for the service. We're able to serve only about 23 kids now. So as we, you know, come upon this celebration of 25 years, our goal really is to help people become aware of what the program does, help identify individuals in our communities that have a real passion for helping children in this kind of situation who are very vulnerable to find a better life, get better outcomes in their cases. So our goal really is to, as we celebrate 25 years, get 25 new volunteers in Story County that can actually help serve the children there who need this kind of advocacy support.
This sounds like a very, very important event for people to be aware of so that they can become more aware and perhaps volunteer. So could you give us the details on this this event coming up? I believe it's tomorrow night, right, on the 14th?
It is. Tomorrow, June 14th at 4:30 p.m. The event will take place at the Gateway Hotel in Ames, 2100 Green Hills Drive, just south of Highway 30. It's an important event, and we would love to have anyone in the community that's interested in helping children or wanting to know about more about our program. In addition to people that might be interested in volunteering, we're to become advocates. We also are in need of volunteers that can actually help support the program in other ways, or who can help spread the word about what we do. It's just really important to get that communication going in the community.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for telling us about this very important work. We've been speaking, thank you, with...
Thank you.
Jim Hennessy.
With Jim Hennessy. And would you play some music to sort of bridge the next few minutes?
Just can't be found.
This is KHOI Community Radio. Good morning. I'm one of your hosts for today, Dennis Hart, welcoming Councilmember Bronwyn Beattie Hansen together with our newest Councilmember, David Martin. Thanks for coming in on Wednesday after last night's, not as long as usual, I suppose, but still a long council meeting. We appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and good morning.
Good morning. Bronwyn, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing well, thank you.
It's been a year since we've seen each other. We used to do this live in person, then we did it on the telephone for a while, so here we are back live. Last night's council session, packed audience at the start, as it has been. And there were a couple of, well, several major issues discussed. One of them, the ongoing issue of the rezoning of Lincoln Way. And this is controversial, to say the least. Last night, you had a couple of ordinances that you were approaching, and you sort of delayed action on one of them. You amended one of them involving setting the standards for what you hope will be Lincoln Way development between Grand and Duff Avenues and a block north and a block south of Lincoln Way. Tell me about what happened last night with that amendment. You were about to approve it, and then it got amended. In what way?
Well, the change we made was to change existing businesses that are in the area. When we put in the new zoning district, instead of becoming nonconforming, if they weren't already, they will become pre-existing is the status technically. And that gives them, I think, hopefully some comfort. A lot of the complaints we heard were from business owners who were very scared about their ability to sell their property if it were labeled as non-conforming, their business. So the change to pre-existing allows them to one, not have the label non-conforming attached to their business. And then also it allows them to expand their business on their property if they would want to.
Now, you voted in favor of it, but David, you opposed that last night.
That's correct.
Tell me why.
Well, I felt that the protections offered by the non-conforming status were good enough. I thought that that allowed existing business owners to continue their uses on that site in the way that as far as I can tell, most of them have been doing for many years now. And so I didn't feel like it was a necessary change to accomplish the goals that we'd set out for this new zone.
This is a controversial issue, to say the least, because a lot of business owners on Lincoln Way, as you both know, feel threatened by what's about to happen. What can you tell them? I mean, there's no question you're setting the stage for new development, a new look on Lincoln Way. What can you tell those existing people who've been there for a long time and who think you're trying to push them out?
Well, I would say that the goal here is not to push anyone out at all. The goal is to take advantage of natural transitions in a business cycle. When someone decides that they want to sell their business or just their property, and there's, you know, some sort of organic natural transition, that the new use of that site is in accordance with the new zoning principles. And so that's sort of the difference here between the non-conforming status that we previously had and the if pre-existing status that was enacted last night. So under the non-conforming status, I think it's more of an incentive for people to consider the new, more favored uses in the zone than it would be under the new ordinance that we crafted last night, which basically would say that even the old uses would be just as favored as they previously were. And in fact, they could intensify those uses pretty much as they wanted, as long as they adhered to the structural standards, how the building is built, that sort of thing.
I was a little bit taken by surprise last night by the mayor's announcement that he and Steve Shanker and Kelly Diekman are going to meet with businesses tomorrow while you're discussing this ordinance. I won't ask you if you were surprised by this, but what could that possibly mean in terms of this whole thing going forward?
Well, I think the purpose of that meeting is mostly to comfort people and address misconceptions that they might have heard, because we have heard a lot of misconceptions about what the rezoning means. You know, I've even heard people use the term eminent domain to say that the government is taking this property, which is absolutely not what we're doing. And so I think the meeting is really meant to answer any questions that business owners have about what that means for their property and mostly to hopefully reassure them.
How does this all play out with that the elephant that may be in the room at some point, what we've heard of a potentially proposed development, a big one along Lincoln Way involving mixed use, residential, new commercial, et cetera. We haven't heard that officially, but we're all hearing it might be coming. Does this play into all of that? Are you setting the stage for that, in other words, with this rezoning?
I think it's kind of the other way around. I think the proposed rezoning really spurred this proposal into faster action than we would have seen it otherwise. So I think without council discussing a rezoning at all, I don't know that we would have seen the proposal. But since they knew we were thinking about this idea, and this was going to be a change coming down the works, I think that's why we saw that development proposed.
Is the whole idea of this rezoning, to put it bluntly, to avoid a South Duff Avenue look on Lincoln Way?
I would say it's more positive looking than an avoidance strategy. It is an effort to look at a neighborhood in a situation where there's an opportunity to set a consistent tone for the decades that are going to come, rather than just waiting to see what incrementally happens over time. And so, in that sense, I think it is different. It is taking a holistic view at this part of town and addressing the question, what do we want this to be? Do we want it to be a destination in its own right, a place that people are going to go in order to stay for a while? Or is it just something that people pass through on their way elsewhere?
It's going to look different, isn't it, from anything we've seen?
Yeah. And I think there's the aesthetic element, and then there's also the infill goal. And that, I think, is a big goal of what we're doing in this area, too. Just as Ames grows and continues to grow, we need to either increase density in the core of the city, or we tend to sprawl. I mean, that's how cities go. So I think this is a strategy to take advantage of some opportunity for increasing density in the core of town.
Wouldn't be a city council meeting without discussing rental caps. You have to do that for at least a couple of hours, and you did last night. And it was just as confusing at times, and I have followed this now for a year, as everybody else has. Last night was just as confusing as other get-togethers have been. Last night you were discussing hardship exemptions for the rental concentration campus. Try as I might, I'm sitting there and I followed this for a year. It was a hard one. In a simple form, can you tell us what you did last night in terms of starting process toward hardship exemptions for people who want to sell their property but are right up against the 25% cap that you've put on rental properties in seven nearby neighborhoods near Iowa State? What did you do last night?
Well, let me describe one of them. This is something that we've previously called Option 1 just because of how it was expressed at one point. And the idea of this is to address the situation where the hardship involves a disproportionate effect of the rental cap on a particular area of a neighborhood. In other words, there's property that's surrounded by other rentals, and that makes it hard for them to sell that property
right.
to an owner-occupant.
That's right.
So that's Option 1. And what we did under that option is to describe a procedure. And we basically drafted the ordinance. We didn't vote on the ordinance yet, but it's pretty close. We drafted this procedure whereby an owner who has tried to sell their house, it's surrounded, they can't sell it, they can come to the city and say, look, the only way you're going to get residence in this house is if you allow us to turn it into a rental. And so then that application would be evaluated, and it might result then in a rental permit being awarded to that property that would allow it to become a rental so people can live there.
Yeah, and the second of the big topics we undertook was what we had referred to as Option 3, and that's really, in a most simple form, a time frame that we would give current property owners to have one last chance to apply for a rental permit, basically, for their properties. We put some, I think, pretty steep time frames on it. So they only have a 4-week window to apply. They have 6 months to come into compliance with any changes they need to make to the property in order to comply. And then they have to rent the property within a year or they lose their letter of compliance. And that one was, I think of the two, it was definitely the more controversial. We seem to have broad support for Option 1, Option 3 less so.
As the mayor said last night, and David, you made this point as well, that you need to look at the entire neighborhood, the well-being of the neighborhood in the city as part of an entire organic city, as opposed to trying to guarantee that individual homeowners don't get harmed in some form or fashion. So I guess one would ask, are you going – you're looking at hardship options. What to keep everybody from the neighbor in the neighborhood from saying, we can't sell our house, so it's a hardship option. We have to rent it. Which – and how does that play out against the 25% rental cap you're putting on the neighborhoods? Every exception you grant puts it above 25% or keeps it there. How do you reconcile those?
Well, for both of these options that we've described, there's a significant set of requirements in order to begin your application. As Bronwyn just said, there's a time frame requirement for what we've called option three, and then for the other requirement. And so that'll expire, right? If you don't get your application in by currently September 1st is mm-hmm. what we're imagining, yeah. then that opportunity is passed altogether. There's no second chance at that. And for option one, it would require you to actually show that you are surrounded by other rentals, that you've tried to sell the house, that the offers that came in, if any, were inadequate, that you've been unable to sell the house. And so it's a fairly high bar. It's not something that will change rapidly over time. 5 years from now, the chances that you suddenly become eligible for that option, whereas previously you weren't, I'd say those chances are small, or at least they're intended to be small.
So options one and three are still on the table. They're about to be incorporated
yes.
into the ordinance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that should guarantee no more discussion, right? There won't be a packed audience anymore. I'm joking about that because this is obviously the most controversial issue that the city has seen in a while, and mm-hmm. it is so complex to get your arms around this. And every meeting has to be – and by the way, the level of discussion last night I thought was incredibly high on everybody's part, on the council and on the people who are in favor of hardship exemptions. And some of the neighborhood representatives said, we're already at 60%, 70% rentals. How many more can we have? It's got to be a very difficult balancing act for you two on the council.
Yeah, true. And I think you're right in the sense that we're not done talking about it yet either. Another element we really need to – get under control or have a discussion about is how we encourage the conversion of rental properties back to owner-occupied properties. So what, you know, if that looks like an incentive program or some sort of grant program, you know, however we do that, we need to have that discussion yet too, which I think will be another big piece in how we bring the neighborhoods back from, you know, some being at 60-70%.
Do you think it's possible to bring some of those neighborhoods back over years, bring them down from 60-70 to anywhere close to the 25%?
I mean, it would take a long time to get from 70 to 25, mm-hmm. but I think we can bring them down some. You know, I hear, I guess, you know, it's anecdotal, but I hear stories all the time about people who would love to be able to find a home in Ames they could purchase mm-hmm. To live in, but instead they go to Nevada or Store City. And so this is really a guaranteed stock of those houses. And that, I think we'll see that the market is there for owner-occupied homes.
And if we see these incentive programs actually materialize once we're able to enact them, then that has a hope of being able to actually reduce some of the rental percentage numbers in some of these neighborhoods. I would say that the cap itself, the mechanisms we currently have in place, are not likely to reduce things that much. They prevent the further conversion of owner-occupied to rentals. But by themselves, I think it would take a long time for them to reduce very much. I will say one thing, though. One of the figures that was cited last night about 70% rental in a neighborhood, turns out that was just a mistaken figure. The figure in that neighborhood was closer to, I think it's closer to 50%. And that's one of the problems here. We have so many moving parts mm-hmm. Once one idea gets out there at one point, it kind of gets repeated even though maybe it's been updated or it was never correct to begin with.
Have about 90 seconds left here. Let's talk about what you did last night with the city-owned tennis courts at Ames High School. That's going to impact some people out there. What action did you take on that?
Well, we decided to terminate our agreement with the school district. And this is really following some actions that they're taking. You know, obviously, they're planning a redo of the high school, and they Their plan is to have tennis courts on the 24th Street site with the administrative buildings. And so that was the action we undertook on that.
Okay. And what happens to the existing courts here? They're going to be plowed up, right, when the new Ames High School goes in?
That's our understanding, yes.
And will residents have access to the new courts that are going in on 24th?
That's the hope, although it's an unknown. So, the hope is that that the school district would allow public use of that facility, as they do some other outdoor facilities they have, too. But we can't say for sure.
We are out of time. Bronwyn, Beatty Hansen, and David Martin, thank you for coming in. We'll see you on the radio again in a little while.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Local Talk, and I am Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today. Thanks to my co-host, Dennis Hart, you have been listening to a news-filled program. So it's suitable that we're ending with an event to watch for in the upcoming news, a lawsuit about to be filed by Bob Watson of Decorah against the DNR for failing to enforce its own rules on air quality in CAFO's confined animal feeding operations. Here's KHOI's nature reporter, Pat Schlarbaum, talking with Bob about the issue.
What is your home and what is your profession, Mr. Watson?
Okay, so we live outside of Decorah. We live northeast of Decorah on a dead-end road that goes down to the Upper Iowa River. We've been here for approximately 40 years, and I make my living in the wastewater industry. I have a rep firm, and so I represent manufacturer and service provider companies in the wastewater industry.
And what is your assessment? What is the water quality in our fair state?
Well, with as much as we contribute to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, our water is atrocious.
Bob, you've entered into an alliance of working with other like-minded individuals. Can you give us some background on what your current efforts are?
Okay, well, actually, our lawsuit that we've got going now, the other plaintiffs are Dick Jansen from here in Decorah, Larry Stone from El Cater, and Lou Clemish, who lives southwest of here a little ways. And our lawsuit against the DNR is about the air side. Many people have been dealing with water issues with refinements in Iowa, but since 1999, with the article that I wrote called "Is the Pork You Eat Raised in a Sewer?", my emphasis has been on the air emissions coming from hog confinements as equally dangerous or even more immediately dangerous to humans. And even though this may be about water, and water is affected by confinement once the waste is spread, what we're concentrating on and what I have been concentrating on for 20 years now is the air emissions and the problems that they create.
Are there health concerns primarily?
Yeah, definitely. The hydrogen sulfide will affect the central nervous system, will affect the digestive system, and if you're too close, it'll actually kill you, which we see in the confinement deaths that happen both with workers and the pigs. And that's one of the reasons that all of these confinements must exhaust their air emissions all the time, because if the power is cut off for any reason, pigs will be dead within 20 minutes because of the hydrogen sulfide inside of the confinement.
So you're describing a confinement animal feeding operation that has the pit lagoon for all the waste underneath the animals,
right.
and the slotted floor allows that effluent to go into the pit, and then there's hydrogen sulfide that is being exhausted by the big fans.
Right, hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, methane, volatile organic compounds, antibiotic-resistant organisms, particulates, 2.5 and otherwise particulates, all of these are being exhausted in the air emissions that come out of hog confinements, and so they affect the health of the people in proximity. And So ammonia will do asthma and other irritations, skin irritations, and some such. The methane, of course, is a, you know, will actually explode. That's why we have burning confinements and exploding confinements, and it's also a pretty bad climate change gas. The ammonia goes up into the air and combines with volatilized anhydrous ammonia that's sprayed on crops in Iowa for fertilizer, and that has created a cloud over the Midwest, an ammonia cloud over the Midwest, which drifts east. And when it rains, well, here in Iowa, well, it's ammonia nitrate that precipitates out, and it's a new acid rain. The old acid rain was sulfuric acid rain. The new acid rain, which was discovered by the Bill Schlesinger's outfit, they discovered the first sulfuric acid rain, and they've also discovered this new nitric acid rain. And so it's not only a proximal problem around confinement, a neighborhood problem. It ends up being a statewide problem, a Midwest-wide problem, and an eastern United States problem because of the precipitation of the acid rain. And that acid rain is doing similar destruction that the old acid rain did.
I can recall the acid rain issues back in the 80s. 70s and 80s. So is this being looked at scientifically? Are you aware of any studies?
Sure. So the lawsuit that will be filed here, what happened on our most recent one is that we asked the DNR to issue a declaratory order stating that the air emissions from hog confinements contain manure. And that's illegal according to Iowa law. All manure must be retained in the confinements between what they call disposal events, which are basically land application events. The definition, the state definition of manure, they call it excreta, actually it says that it's anything that comes off of a pig or out of a pig or feed loss inside a confinement. So basically everything inside a confinement is excreta by the state's definition. And since this is an anaerobic environment, this manure doesn't break down like it does when it's outside deposited on land like we used to raise pigs on pasture and hog lots, where the air, wind, water, sunlight, insects, other animals, organisms, soil organisms would break down that manure into its constituent parts, which was valuable for the nutrient uptake cycle with fertilizer. In hog confinement, that's a wastewater technology. It's an anaerobic digester, basically. It's poorly designed and poorly operating, but it's still an anaerobic digester. And that waste breaks down in a completely different environment. It's no oxygen, no sunlight, no air, no insects, no other organisms that would normally break it down. And it's broken down into compounds, including hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, the antibiotic-resistant organisms that are in the pigs, and the particulates, volatile organic compounds. And so these basically constituent parts of the manure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, with this particular lawsuit, we sued the EPA a few years ago, and we filed 177 medical and scientific research papers along with that one. In this lawsuit, we've filed 867 peer-reviewed journal studies that justify our position. We could have filed more, but we finally thought that enough was enough of that. 867 ought to tell the story. And they also reference hundreds and thousands of more studies in their studies. And so this is not just some kind of a thing that we think this is happening. The science is fairly mature on hog confinements nowadays. We do have a couple of experts that have agreed to put in their own studies that show both, you know, antibiotic-resistant organisms. The one expert that we have is Tara Smith. She used to be at the University of Iowa. She is the person that discovered the MRSA, ST-398 MRSA, that's unique to hog confinements. She discovered them, was the first person to discover that MRSA line in Iowa and Illinois confinements when she was still at Iowa. She's now at Kent State University.
And MRSA, that's an acronym for...
It's the antibiotic-resistant methods.
We don't really have a cure for any sort of
MRSA. No, there's, that's the whole thing about, antibiotics and antibiotic resistance, and that's part of the reason that the FDA, like a year or two ago, came out with their veterinary feed directive, which was supposedly going to try and help quit using so many antibiotics in agriculture so that, that the antibiotic-resistant problem that's just horrible nowadays would be helped. But that basically ended up, that was an Obama administration, and I believe that the Trump administration has basically just ignored that, just put it on hold like they put so many of the other regulatory things on hold. And so, we find there are research papers that show that even when the waste is spread out on fields, people can still be colonized from the MRSA, the antibiotic-resistant organisms that are in that waste, even when it's out on the field. In fact, there was a study done on VA hospital in Iowa City on their outpatients, and that study showed that a veteran who lived within a mile of a hog confinement was three times more likely to be colonized with MRSA than a veteran that lived more than a mile outside of it. So the science on this is, as I say, is very mature, widespread. We've got studies from hog confinements here in Iowa, in the rest of the United States, in Taiwan, in China. It's a problem that's in the last 10 or 15 years being studied very well around the world. And these are all peer-reviewed journal studies. Mm. So.
Has your lawsuit been filed?
No, it will be filed in the next few days. What happened was that we asked the DNR for a declaratory order in about the first of the year. And so they had 60 days to respond or not respond. And they didn't respond. And so then we have basically taken the same documents and the same arguments, and the lawyers are putting it in the form that it needs to be in. We'll file it in the next few days in the Polk County District Court in Des Moines.
And our thanks to Pat Schlarbaum and Bob Watson for bringing the issue of dangers inherent in our current animal feeding practices to our attention. If you want more detailed information about the implications of the lawsuit they're talking about, you can go to our website, khoifm.org. And click on the link for Lawsuit Against the DNR in today's program.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Dennis Hart and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Leanne Harter, Jim Hennessy, Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, David Martin, Pat Schlarbaum, and Bob Watson.
And you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. One more time, that's khoifm.org.
Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Bridge Over Troubled Waters by Simon and Garfunkel from their album, The Essential Simon and Garfunkel.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, you can contact us, the number 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, one more time, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know, or the contact information, if you decide to call to become a member or renew your membership. Why not do it today? Just look for that yellow donate button. You'll see it.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOY meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and
we'll
see you again
on the radio. Again, bye.
KHOI is sponsored in part by Ames Electric Services, providing rebates to customers for upgrading to energy-efficient appliances, lighting, thermostats, and air conditioners. Smart energy rebates help you decrease your power needs, which can lower your electric bills. Learn more from www.cityofames.org/smartenergy.